From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1980. The New York City transit strike was causing serious disruption. Mayor Ed Koch's chief architect in responding to the strike was Sam Schwartz. In meetings, Schwartz and his colleagues had created what they called the Gridlock Prevention Plan. On the third day of the transit strike, a reporter heard the term gridlock and used it in print. It was the first time the American public had heard that term, gridlock. But within days, everyone was using it. The great linguist William Safire called Sam Schwartz to ask, where did that come from? Schwartz quickly offered co-credit to another engineer, but two things had already happened. The term gridlock would become part of the American vocabulary, and Sam had a nickname. He'd become known as Gridlock Sam ever since. But you see, for decades, Sam Schwartz has been working to reduce and eliminate gridlock. He's considered perhaps the foremost expert on traffic in the country. He's been helping lead a shift in how we travel, working with cities that want a more multimodal future, Rochester included. And now Sam Schwartz has a new book out. I can honestly say I learned more in this single enjoyable book than I have from any other source on the subjects of the automobile, our history, the streetcar, urban design, the future of transportation. Well, tonight, Schwartz is in Rochester as a guest of the group called Reconnect Rochester. He is their featured guest at an event at the Little Theater at 6:30. But first, he's here, Gridlock Sam Schwartz, and I won't call you that anymore. I know you've been dealing that for decades. It's great to see you. How are you?
Good to see you, Evan.
Well, thanks for being here. Mike Governale is here, the president of Reconnect Rochester. You sent me this book weeks ago, and you said, I know you're going to like this. It was really fascinating stuff.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I knew Sam would be perfect for your show. Every time we are on here talking about how cities are built and how people move around, we seem to get a really great response.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott Wagner's here. In many ways, he's a bicycling advocate. He's someone who's very much interested in multimodal transportation, and he's been on the program before. Great to see you back, Scott.
Thank you very much, Evan. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Eric Frisch is a transportation specialist with the City of Rochester. Did you bike or drive here?
I walked.
You walked? Did
City
you really?
City Hall's right over there.
I should know. This is a few blocks. Yeah. I figured in the rain, though, maybe you'd be weak.
No excuse.
Good for you, Eric.
You can bike and walk in the rain. I did both today.
Well, look, something's happening right now. When we discuss walkability and related issues, we tend to get phone calls from people who say, it's nice, but it's a pipe dream. It's not reality. But in Sam's book, the book's called Street Smart, The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars. And Sam, in your book, you look at a remarkable new trend, kind of a reversal of sorts when it comes to the youngest generation now and the automobile. What's happening?
Yeah, it's something that never happened, at least in my history of monitoring transportation, which is about a half century. But if you go back 120 years, we have always seen an increase in transportation usage, in car usage, which is measured by total number of vehicle miles traveled in the United States. It's gone up. 29 crash, goes down a little bit, then resumes going up. World War II went down a little bit, shot straight up, and then it continued shooting straight up till about 2003. And then something happened that no one predicted. No one can take credit for it. And it was nothing short of revolutionary. And that is for 10 straight years, driving in the United States, whether we're talking about New York City, we're talking about Chicago, we're talking about Omaha, we're talking about Los Angeles. For 10 straight years, driving went down. It preceded the Great Recession. It accelerated through the recession and continued after the recession. So when I looked at what happened, it was largely confined to one group. And it was such a dramatic change that you just don't see in social behavior without a war or something like that. And that is, younger people were driving not 1 or 2% less, which is the normal range of things, 20 to 25% fewer miles. It was extraordinary. And for 10 straight years, that continued to go down. And so I began to take a look at what's going on with the millennials.
And why here? And this is where some really fascinating twists and turns happen in this chapter, because the first thing you think is, well, okay, the millennials are driving less because the financial crash. But as Sam writes in the book, this started before the crash, and every financial crisis or world crisis over the last, essentially the last 100 years, we've seen a dip and then a resumption. Hasn't happened after coming out of the recession. And then you think, well, environmentalism, millennials are, you know, they're driving less because they know of the fossil fuel impact on the planet. But you look at surveys, and that's not the answer either, is it?
No. And I find that there is no one answer. There are a couple of really good things. There's one good thing that government did. and that it's about all the states in the 90s, just about all the states, introduced graduated driver's licensing, which made it a little
harder. This is like the last thing I would have thought would be the culprit, but this is one of the, you know, one of the easiest things to point to as a real possibility here. Tell us again what happened.
So state after state makes it harder for a 16-year-old to drive just with his or her friends, and makes it a little tougher when you're 17. And so you get a little bit older and fewer people getting driver's licenses because of that. And what we've learned is if people by 19 or 20 don't get a driver's license, the probability they will get one drops dramatically because they've learned to be an adult without a car. They've learned other kinds of behaviors. So the graduated driver's license, which, by the way, number of fatalities among 16-year-olds has dropped by 25%, which is wonderful news. But also, the number of people getting driver's licenses at 16, 17, and 18 has plummeted. So people are now going to college. A lot of people go to college, and they don't have a car. And somehow, they manage to function. And then along comes the smartphone and all the apps. And this is something that I learned in doing some of my research. What kept a lot of people, a lot of drivers, from using public transportation is they didn't understand it. I did focus groups, and they had no clue as to how to use the transit system. It was like it was a puzzle, a mystery. Well, now I could take any millennial with his or her smartphone, and I'll drop them in Prague or Jerusalem or Paris or New York City, and they will be an expert by just clicking on an app, and they will tell you which staircase of the subway to get into and out of most efficiently.
Even if they've never been there.
They've never been there. They know what to do.
And as Sam writes,
what's more, they're proud of it. They're very proud of the fact that you put them anywhere, and they can do this.
Yeah.
It's an attitude thing.
As Sam writes, this is a great contrast again. This is what is new, because you used to be able to go to cities, and as Sam writes, you could immediately spot the tourists. You spot the people taking the tube, people on the subway, public transportation in various forms, they all know it, they're in a rhythm with it. And then you find someone who's kind of stumbling, looking around, you know, looking up at the sign and, you know, worried that they're not going to make it on time. And now, all of a sudden, this generation knows how to use these multimodal forms of transportation because the technology makes it easier. Really remarkable.
Yeah, yeah. And they're all experts. And you know, it's the younger generation. It's not my generation. I'm in my 60s. I still like to look at maps, but I will still download an app of a subway system of any city. But there are other things. Anecdotally, speaking to a lot of millennials, I found a lot of millennials, especially that made the switch from the suburbs to the city, their experience in a car was not a very good one. There were angry parents in the front seat, people griping about the traffic. And I say parents in plural because in the 1950s and 60s, when Don Draper of Mad Men, he went off to work and left Betty at home. But by the 80s and 90s, Betty was going to work as well as Don, and the two of them were as unhappy as could be with driving because the mobility had dropped in the United States for driving. It peaked around 1970 to 75, and then speeds started to drop. So all that highway building didn't result in us moving any faster in 2016 on highways, and in fact slower than when we were in the 1950s or 1960s at the start of the big highway program.
Talking to Sam Schwartz, his new book is The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars. The main title is Street Smart, and all I can tell you is I already see I'm going to get through about a quarter of what I want to talk to Sam about this hour. So you got a chance to see him tonight. Mike Governale from Reconnect Rochester, what's going on tonight?
So tonight we will be at the Little Theater. Doors will open at 6 o'clock. The presentation from Sam will start around 6:30, followed by a Q&A session. We'll have a little discussion on stage, and then his book, Street Smart, will be for sale in the theater. And bring a pen. You can get it signed. And I'm ecstatic. I'm so looking forward to this.
Well, I will just say, it just for the history alone, no matter where you stand, maybe you live in the suburbs and you think this is silly and it's never going to happen and you know, life has changed, and maybe you disagree with some of the prescriptions, the ideas that you'll find in Street Smart. The history alone is fascinating. What happened with streetcars, how things progressed. So I I just really enjoyed it so much for those reasons here. And we're going to get to some of your phone calls this hour, especially if you, I'd love to hear from people who maybe you're kind of going against what your parents' generation did. Maybe you drive less. Maybe you don't want a car. Maybe you don't have a car. You can call the program, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Sam is describing this graduated license that I guess came in the mid to late 90s, right?
Yes.
So all of a sudden, as these millennials start to get older, they're used to not driving because they're driving later. It's like so many things. If you don't do it by a certain age, you might never do it. And I don't say that lightly. You can think about reading. If a child's not reading by the third grade, there's trouble. They may never read. They're going to get used to living in this world without reading. People get used to living without driving. And that's sort of what Sam has found here. It's kind of like if you build it, they will come, or if you don't, they won't. And then for some reason, Sam, I thought of 1973 and the story of what happened in 1973. And I think I'd love for you to tell this story to help illustrate the point in a different way here. The if you build it, they will come, and if you don't, if it's not there, maybe they won't. What happened in 1973?
In 1973, I was a young engineer with the New York City Traffic Department, and I got a call one day to race out to the west side of Manhattan because we had an elevated highway called the West Side Highway, built in the late 1920s, early 1930s, and the West Side Highway collapsed. It actually fell to the ground. A heavy truck was traveling on it, and suddenly an entire slab came down, and it looked as if a new ramp was created. Fortunately, the trucker wasn't seriously injured in it, but my job was to handle the traffic, to research the traffic, find out where there was a big increase in traffic, and try to deal with that. And all the research that I did, I was always missing 25 to 35% of the traffic, and sometimes even more. I couldn't trace it. More people were coming into the Central Business District, but the traffic disappeared. And it's like, it's a great mystery. Some people took transit. Some people took other roads. Some people weren't circulating. It didn't kill the city. If anything, the city got better. More people started coming in. And then by the late 1980s, when I was chief engineer, for New York City, I tore the highway down and built a boulevard there, and the city is flourishing. And so we now have experiences of what could happen when you tear down a highway. And I know Rochester is actually engaged in filling in a highway, but the same experience happened in San Francisco when the Embarcadero collapsed. They found they could live without the highway, that if you tear it down, they won't come.
Conversely, Sam, and I'm sure Eric can jump in on this as well, I think I was surprised, and maybe I shouldn't have been, but a little surprised to find about what happens when you build more traffic lanes. A lot of planners will tell you, well, this is a congested area. Let's widen the lanes. Let's add the lanes. Henrietta has a spot that's got 140 lanes at one spot, I think. Is that right, Mike? Something like that. And what happens when you add traffic lanes, Sam?
Yeah, and there have been quite a few studies on this. It doesn't relieve the traffic jams in the long run. What happens is more people drive. There's something called induced demand. And just about every time you build a major highway, you're going to be stealing people from transit or other forms of transportation, or you'll be encouraging people to live further out, and therefore you'll get more driving. So what happens in those cases is you decrease both accessibility and mobility. But if you invest in your inner cities, what you increase then is accessibility, because suddenly you can walk. As Eric said, he walked over. You couldn't walk over from one suburban community to another. If you have the increased density, and if you have the way we lived for all but 100 years of our time on this planet, we did not live with traveling a great deal every single day. We tended to cluster in cities, and in cities we had short trips. If we go back to short trips, your accessibility for store, for entertainment, for schools, everything just shoots up, and you have so much more time in your day to spend with your family or have fun and go out with your friends.
Not sitting in cars. That was another part of what millennials are doing that's different. You know, so why is it then millennials would drive less than their parents. And again, we've been talking about the reasons, but another one is simply that they're connected. Mobile technology means they want to be connected all the time, which you can't, or Sam writes, you really shouldn't be doing when you're driving. And for anybody who's ever sat in an Amtrak train or any kind of transit where you're just a passenger, you can be on a smartphone, and millennials want to do that, so why would they be wanting to drive? It's so interesting to me. Eric, as a transportation specialist with the City of Rochester, what are some of the big takeaways for you from a book like this and some of the research that he's pointing to?
Well, it's certainly consistent with a lot of the things that we've been working on here. And I should note, coincidentally, that we recently engaged Sam's firm to work on our East Main Arts and Market District report, which has been very successful, recently completed just a couple of months ago, where we looked at East Main, just east of downtown from the Inner Loop to Goodman. And it's a very excellent project. I certainly welcome people to look at the website. But certainly,
what website?
The city's website, cityrochester.gov/eastmain, and the report is on there. Lots of recommendations, transportation, streetscape, land use, housing. It's an excellent read. You know, when you look at the law of induced demand, you know, we've done a lot of these road diets where we've taken away lanes on our major streets, and it's the same thing, right? Every time, it's, well, what's going to happen with the people? Whether they're going to slow down, or they're going to have to find another way, and where are they going to go? You're not widening other roads, and so if you look at Monroe, East University, and now we're talking about East Main. We're not seeing that there's any negative decline from this. In fact, what you're seeing is increased investment and people wanting to be there. That just becomes a more comfortable place to be. So we're learning this here, and it's great to have Sam bringing more attention and awareness to that.
Now, when Sam's talking about a New York City, okay, we're not going to add more lanes, or maybe even, you know, take out a traffic structure and put in a boulevard, et cetera. You have a little bit more of a built-in multimodal set of options there. Whereas as a city, we're sort of reconnecting. Look at that, Mike Governale. We're kind of reconnecting with the options.
We're trying to. Yeah, we want to add more modes, more options for people to get around. New York City definitely has some advantages. You've got the population. You've got geography that helps sort of contain the downtown central business district, which we don't. So that sort of allows us to sprawl out more. And Sam has been a big advocate for congestion pricing, which I'm not sure how we would do here without the tunnels and bridges and that sort of thing. But I know there's a streetcar project on the table in Brooklyn and Queens. So, you know, New York City is doing a lot of things to help bring people, you know, back to that neighborhood vibe and leave their cars parked and use other modes to get around. And that helps. We are sort of trying to figure out how we can do that here in Rochester right now.
And Evan, I'd like to go back to Eric's pointing out his website, the city's website, and the plans that they've provided, not only for the East Main, but also for other projects. They're excellent resources, and I'd really like to encourage everyone on the program, everyone listening to the program, to go to those websites and look at those plans. And when you look at them not with the narrow perspective of, oh, where would I park if I went there, but how would I feel if I were walking around there? How would I feel if my daughter was walking around there with her friends? Is this the kind of place that I would like to have a meeting with my friends as opposed to the place as it is right now? And if you ask those kind of questions, you'll see that this is really a much more pleasant cityscape that Eric and his team, with the guidance of Sam and some of the folks who have been working on these plans in Rochester, is providing these days.
Let me grab a couple of phone calls with folks who've been wanting to jump into the conversation, and I want to start with John and Geneseo. Go ahead, John.
Yes, hi. I'd just like to say, really enjoy the program. Long-time listener, first-time caller, so thank you to everybody.
Thanks.
I really enjoy the show. And I'm in the millennial generation. I actually work for a service driving a car, and I don't own a car.
Do you live in Geneseo, or do you work in Geneseo?
I live and work in Geneseo, sir, and I'll go between Rochester and Buffalo. And I guess what I wanted to say was, one of the things I've noticed is that when I was younger, cars were less expensive. They have sort of not dropped in price to any appreciable levels, especially in New York State. Insurance is expensive, and even though gas prices are dropped, it's still expensive. So I guess money is one of the big factors that we're not driving. I know at least my friends will, somebody will have a car, everybody throws in a couple bucks for gas, something like that, and it's just a better system. And when I was younger, one of the cars I had was an older car, and it was easier to work on. It was easier to maintain. and it lasted longer. And as I got older and bought other cars, cars seem to have fallen into a category of planned obsolescence. So when people look at them, it's less of an investment and more of something that's a drain on money, essentially. So that was the gist of my comment.
Yeah, John, thanks for the phone call. And I think you'll find a lot in Sam's book to appreciate on some of those points there. The expensive issue of it. Cars are not very egalitarian, are they, Sam?
No, they're not. And John brings up a couple of good points. It's a hassle, and it costs a lot of money. And millennials are making decisions that it's not worth the hassle or not worth the money. And that's why many of them are foregoing cars.
Now, I want to hit one, before I get back to the phones, kind of an addendum to what John is saying there is that for him it's less expensive, but think of really our entire community, all ranges and all walks of life of people, all socioeconomic backgrounds. Eric, in what you're doing in Rochester, Sam, what you've done in your career, how do you make sure that your planning for transportation, multimodal transportation, is egalitarian, is accessible for people, and doesn't essentially leave people behind? I'll start with Sam.
Yeah. There's a chapter in my book called Tuxedos on the Subway.
That's right.
Yeah. And one of the problems in some transit systems is they are viewed as transportation for the poor. So I have friends in Los Angeles that tell me nobody rides the subway in Los Angeles, which is not true, but it means people like me, they mean themselves, people like them, they don't ride the subway. They see it as transportation for lower income people. So the best transportation systems are the ones that include both lower, middle, and upper income people, and those are the ones that get funded the most and the best. So that ought to be how one is striving to build a transportation system. And transit should be egalitarian. And that's part of the problem with some of the new services that come up. They will always service where the people have the money. Yeah, Uber and others, they're less likely to serve the lower income communities. But government has a responsibility to make sure all communities are served.
Yeah. Eric, what do you think?
Well, as you know, in this city, there's a large percentage of the population that does not have access to a private automobile. And if you're designing a city wholly around the automobile, then you are effectively putting up barriers to their ability to participate in the regional economy. And that ties in with transportation and also with land use decisions. I don't think it's a controversial statement to say that transportation has a role to play in the poverty issues that we deal with here in the city. And it's certainly been identified by the Anti-Poverty Initiative as a key consideration. And there are recommendations to that end to create more dense, multimodal, mixed-use nodes that are supportive for people to have better transportation options.
Okay. There's a great quote in Sam's book. He says, no matter how well laid out the sidewalks and bike paths of a city's active transportation network, no matter how cleverly designed its multimodal grid, if the city's public transportation becomes a system only for the less well-off, it's in trouble. And I can't help but think about Rochester's transportation, public transportation system. We have a dollar fare, which is very good for city residents. But maybe we need to look at more of a use-based fare where the longer your trip is, maybe zones or, maybe if you're riding out to the suburbs, the dollar fare really, is more to the advantage of people who live out in the suburbs than it is for the people who need it most in the city. So I'd like to see us look at those options.
All right, Brian and Henrietta, next up. Go ahead, Brian.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm excited you guys are talking about this. It's one of my favorite rants with family and friends. I'm sure I drive them nuts. And I'm going to run on by a copy of Sam's book. I wanted to just toss a couple things to you guys to talk about and then let you talk about it because I think this is a really important topic and it's critical for our culture in general. One of them is, I don't know if you've ever researched the streetcar conspiracy. I've read up on it, but some of the sources on the internet are kind of questionable, like Wikipedia is probably the most reliable one. And I'm just curious if anybody has done a more scholarly study of that. Another one is that I think we missed an opportunity when we bailed out the auto companies that we didn't somehow tie that to making them start to build infrastructure for mass transit. And Wow, now I can't remember what my third one was.
Well, you've given us a lot. Brian, let me jump in and just say streetcars. Yeah, Sam, you know anything about the... He's talking about a conspiracy with streetcars. You want to address that?
Yeah, Brian, you'll get a lot of the history when you pick up my book. And, you know, a quick... If you wanted to get the quick version of it, you get Who Framed Roger Rabbit? And you'll see Los Angeles, the detective is asked why he doesn't own a car in L.A. in the 1940s. He says, a car in L.A.? L.A.'s got the best transit system in the world. But then the evil Judge Doom wants to kill the streetcar system and build this new thing called a freeway. Well, in the 1930s, a number of companies that benefited from the automobile, including General Motors and Phillips Petroleum, Goodyear Tire, formed these transit companies, and I put quotes around it. Their goal was to convert streetcar lines into bus lines, which buses used all of their products. And they were quite successful. They were successful in New York. They were successful in Los Angeles. I don't know if they were in Rochester, but they probably were successful here too. And as a result, nearly all the streetcar systems in the United States were destroyed, replaced by buses. Ultimately, there was a trial and there was a conviction, and these companies were found guilty. And they were fined $5,000 and told not to do it again. That was in the late 1940s. So, yes, the conspiracy is real. There were convictions on the conspiracy. You can read the court cases on it. They are available. But I think your other idea about getting the auto industry to invest in transit, that's a pretty good one. I didn't think of it at the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't get that in the book. But there is, Brian, there's a ton on streetcars. Fascinating history that I did not know about until Sam's book. But real briefly, the future. You know, people talk about, well, we're not going to see, you know, a widespread use of rickshaws or horse and buggies, but streetcars in the future. They're in the present.
Yep. Yeah, and streetcars, what I call the next generation streetcars.
Yeah.
And the next gen streetcars don't have overhead wires. They have power systems. They either get powered from below, they get recharged, they have batteries or hydrogen fuel cells or both or hybrid technologies. I built a small system on the island of Aruba, and the one that I've proposed for Brooklyn and Queens also would be self-powered streetcars. Seattle put in three streetcars and now is putting in a fourth streetcar. They've been successful in a number of places and not terribly successful where people use them as a gimmick. They should be real transportation. If you're just putting it in because you want to make your downtown look a little sexier, that's not it. It's got to serve the public, and it's not a tourist attraction.
Your book does a very interesting job taking us to different cities where interesting things are happening. It makes me want to go to Charleston even more than I did. I used to go on and go to Charleston for the food. Now I want to go just to see more of what's happening on the transportation sector. But what city in this country is doing the most effective job of moving into the multimodal future, Sam?
Seattle is one of them. You know, Seattle is actually commissioning a study, and we're involved in taking a look at the future, which includes autonomous vehicles, and trying to figure out just what the role of autonomous vehicles would be. Los Angeles already passed a referendum to tax themselves, but they have a second referendum to build more transit, and they're taxing themselves to build transit. This is a man-bites-dog story because this is the auto capital, and you need a two-thirds vote to get that passed, and they were successful. The next referendum is $120 billion to be voted on this November. If they get that, they will become a transit capital in the United States. They will compete with some of the other cities like Chicago and New York City. But an outlier that you wouldn't expect, Salt Lake City. They're doing great transportation. And here it shows that at the local level, it's not red versus blue. It's what's best for the people at the local level. So you have Republican mayors, Salt Lake City, Republican mayor of Oklahoma City says, I'm tired of our city being one of the fattest cities in America. We've got to put our roads on diets. We've got to go on diets. We've got to get out there and walk. using transit consumes well over 20% more calories than if you drive, and it has so many other health benefits if you use transit combined with walking or biking.
And Scott loved the part in the book that said the most efficient form of transportation on the planet is still the bicycle, right?
It really is.
98% or something efficient, something like that?
It really is. And one of the things that I think people sort of have difficulty conceptualizing, my daily commute is 10 miles. I ride 10 miles on my bicycle all weather, no matter what. Not everyone is going to do that. Very few people are going to do that. But the type of problem that the bicycle does solve very effectively is the last mile problem. So my 10-mile commute, which is not something that most people would think feasible, suddenly becomes very feasible if they're riding a half a mile from their house to a transit point, using transit point to move themselves and the bicycle to a half mile from or a mile from work, and then ride the rest of the way to work. Another thing that's really very important to consider here is that it's not just home to work, and it's not just two-point transportation trips that are of interest here. Many people, and interestingly, especially women, there's a gender bias here, especially women will tend to do multi-point trips where they will go from home to a morning destination, to a meeting, to work, to a destination after work for shopping, to a destination to meet friends, and so forth. These will be multi-point trips. Once again, having a good centralized or well-planned transportation network that can serve people with bicycles, and then using the bicycle to solve that last mile problem, makes a very efficient transportation system for the metropolis.
All right. Comment on buses from Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
My comment has to do with the fact that in our city and state, the transportation system has a specific set of arrangements in terms of who's in control. And you mentioned the words regarding the current generation that's emerging. But really, the people who use the bus the most are the ones who depend on the bus. And one of the biggest problems, and we can't look at things unless we are willing to change the politics of some of these things, and one of the politics that needs to be changed is that in New York, there's a board of commissioners that makes decisions regarding transportation systems in each of the local areas and regional areas. And that those boards are basically controlled by people living in counties with a little bit more representation with cities, but there are usually people in the city who are privileged and don't have to depend on the bus. So the change that really needs to happen here is that there needs to be a method for, and they're looking at new commissioners right now, I'm sure they've already decided who that's going to be, that should be people who actually depend on, that's the key word here, depend on the bus. They're using the poor, the people elderly, people with disabilities, because without doing that, all we're doing is talking about people who are privileged. And I'm not saying that shouldn't be part of the conversation, but we need to stop this, class warfare issue where we just don't care about people who are poor, even though people use the words. The other thing is that when they went to the dollar fare, when the transit company, RGRTS, recently changed the routes and had the transit center, what most people don't realize, because of people in the city often who depend on the bus have to use get off and on more buses, their rates, because of having to go to the transit center and then get on another bus, the rates, routes used to go through all the city have to pay another dollar. So actually, in a lot of ways, the people who live in the city, given what I just said, compared to the suburbs, are paying more money than those who have, generally more money to spend.
All right, Bonnie, let me just jump in and let Eric Frisch respond first. Transportation specialist for the city. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, I can't speak on behalf of the Transit Authority. All I can say is I certainly understand that, and the transfer issue is something that we've heard loud and clear about. We're in constant contact with RTS these days, talking about new initiatives. We've talked a long time about having a downtown circulator and that concept, a free, fast, and
you want to give me odds? This comes up every time we talk sort of multimodal transportation. Odds that we're going to see a downtown circulator in the next 5 years.
Hmm. Well, I'm an optimist, so I'll go ahead and say 75%.
Wow. Nice.
The time is right. Downtown is rapidly changing, and as we try and encourage more and better transportation options for people so that people can have a car light or car free lifestyle downtown. That's something that has to be talked about.
I want to get to a very, very short break and come back with more with Sam Schwartz. He is the author of the new book called Street Smart: The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars. He is probably, no overstatement here, the foremost expert on traffic and transportation in the country, had a long career in doing it, and he's in Rochester today. Tonight, 6:30 at the Little Theater. The doors open at 6 for an event there. The book will be there. Sam will be there. You can meet some of the folks from Reconnect Rochester. And when we come back, our intern, Kate Cowie Haskell, is a millennial, is exactly the kind of person that Sam writes about. And again, I know not all millennials are the same. I mean, but at the same time, Kate read the book, and I think she really gravitated towards some of the ideas here. So we sent her out to ride the bus, to meet some of the folks from Reconnect Rochester, to kind of take a look at, is Rochester getting on the same kind of track that the Seattles of the world, for example, are? When we come back, Kate's report on that. Stay with us. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections. Now is the time of year that a lot of local farms are thinking about their CSAs. We'll be talking about community-supported agriculture and how you still have time to hook up with them if you want to. Then in our second hour, Jack Garner, longtime local film critic, joins us to preview the Oscars. Who are the contenders? Who's likely to win and who should win? That's all Thursday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Nazareth College Art Center, presenting Child's Play, The Cat in the Hat. Sally and her brother's boring day changes when the cat in the hat shows up. Saturday, March 5th at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. artcenter.naz.edu.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Mike Governale, president of Reconnect Rochester. They want to come out tonight to see Sam Schwartz at the Little Theater. How long is the event? What's it cost to come attend?
The event will be about an hour and a half to 2 hours long. It's a free event. We're requesting donations. A suggested donation would be between $5 and $15, and those proceeds go to Reconnect Rochester. Sam Schwartz will be giving a presentation. We'll do a Q&A session, discussion with the audience, and then afterwards you can purchase a copy of Sam's book at the show and have it signed by Sam.
And if you ride the bus there and back, it'll cost you $2 and you won't have to look for a place to park.
That's right.
Kate Cowie Haskell is our intern who not only picked up the book and read it, but really appreciated so many of the themes and lessons from the book. And so here's Kate's report, going out in Rochester trying to find out where are we when it comes to American cities and it comes to sort of the future of multimodal transportation.
Attention, any customers at gate 18 are waiting.
I'm standing in the middle of the new RTS Transit Center. The building is streamlined and clean and efficient, all things that are not often associated with public transit. But perceptions of public transportation and urban life seem to be changing, and the new transit center represents a rebranding of the regional transit service that coincides with a national shift towards car-free urban living. People, especially younger generations, are choosing city life over suburbia and transit over cars. Larger cities in particular, such as Austin and San Diego, have experienced a huge influx of millennials who have moved into the city with plans to stay. But what's happening in Rochester? Is this trend towards urbanization happening here? And what does it mean for our city?
I'm Dan, I live car-free, and I believe that we can reconnect Rochester.
For 27-year-old Dan Speciale, a native Rochesterian, it means that a new age of urban life and transit is on the horizon. I catch a bus with Dan at the transit center, a daily stop for him as he commutes between his jobs and his volunteer position at Reconnect Rochester, a local organization that advocates for a multimodal transit network as a means to revitalize the city.
The commute is such a mindless experience by car on highway. You're in this little bubble, you often kind of wake up in the parking lot of where you worked, like, oh, okay, how'd I get here? Commuting by bus now and by bike, I experience the city, I experience the people, the buildings, the sights, the smells on such a human level. And it's so much more mindful, it's so much more, I think, kind of positive and energizing. And it's just a nicer way to participate in the area in which I live.
And transit does seem like a good place to start fixing our community, given that the decisions made about transit in the 1950s and 60s helped facilitate the decline of downtown. In the 1950s, Rochester, like many other cities across the country, decided that the interstate highway system was necessary for an efficient flow of people and goods through the city. Beyond physically separating neighborhoods and prioritizing cars over people, the thruway facilitated a segregation that has left downtown reeling. However, we have to remember that this is not how it always was or has to be.
People tend to forget that how it has been recently is not how it always was. And so, you know, when people talk about, oh, you're insane to think that Rochester would ever have a trolley, Rochester had a trolley when my great-grandfather immigrated here in 1920. It had a network of trolleys. It also had a subway that served people. And, you know, to believe that that all has sort of sailed and can never be achieved again, I think, is to buy into this notion that suburbia is the status quo, is, you know, like the natural evolution of human living, which is not the case at all. I've talked to a lot of people who are ditching the house in the burbs because they don't want the responsibility, they don't want the stress, they don't want the bills, all of that, and they're moving back into the city. And I know that that's a national trend. You know, people are wanting, I think, to simplify, to be closer to the things they need, to be closer to one another. So I don't think it's exclusively young people that are attracted to this. I think the ideas of accessibility, culture are universally desirable.
But we don't see that trend coming very quickly. Why do you think that people are holding on to suburban lifestyle?
Well, for the past 50 plus years, we've constructed a built environment that almost necessitates automotive travel. I'm absolutely convinced that it's very doable. We can make these choices to sort of change the built environment to allow people to have, you know, more options in terms of mobility.
So what does your ideal Rochester look like?
Mike Governale, the founder of Reconnect Rochester, drew this awesome little graphic, and it's the background of our website and some of our social media pages. But it's just this like bright, happy, green, cool little Rochester, and there's like a train running through it and a trolley, and the river is prominent. And I don't know, in my head, that right there, Mike's sketch, is my ideal Rochester. I just think that that is far from a pipe dream. I think it's not only incredibly doable, something that can be realized, but I think it's so incredibly necessary.
So is this ideal Rochester within reach? The numbers might suggest otherwise. While the rest of the nation has seen stagnant new car sales over the last few years, Rochester's new car sales have increased by 20% over the last decade. Some people, like Dan, would say this demand for cars is induced by the built environment. But the demand may also be indicative of a persistent suburban culture. Tony Connors, president of the Greater Rochester Association of Realtors, is in the business of marketing the built environment, and she does not see suburban life disappearing anytime soon.
That's part of our livelihood, to help those developing their families and getting married, having families. They normally do want to have their own home yard for the children. So I don't think that will ever go away.
And Rick Herman, executive vice president of the Rochester Home Builders Association, expects that as millennials age, they too will choose the suburbs as their permanent home.
I don't think you're going to see houses being torn down in Greece and houses being torn down in Penfield. I think you're going to see those new millennials, those people that are in the 30s now, vegetate out of downtown because they no longer want to go to the bars or the restaurant. They're going to go to that inner ring around Central City.
However the city of Rochester and its suburbs grow in the future, it demands an increase in connectivity between urban and suburban, between people and the places they pass through, and the people they pass by. Back on the bus, Dan remains convinced that transit could serve as one of Rochester's most powerful tools for reconnection.
It's very easy to not care at all about the city when the city is something that you drive in and out of for work. It is very easy to write it off, to not be invested, because you're not interacting with the people who live there, you're not interacting with the space. Those of us who catch the bus, who bike, we see the buildings, we see the streets, we hear people, we hear the conversations, and I think it creates more of an empathy, more of a sense of community that we so desperately need here.
Approaching Emerson and Dewey.
That's great work from Kate Cowie Haskell bringing us that story. And so let me turn to Sam Schwartz now with a caveat here. The title of the book, the subtitle is The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars, but you warn readers in the book, you are not saying cars are going to be gone. They will be here in many forms into the future. It's just, I think, sort of maybe a little bit different than what we're used to with our parents grew up with, right? Kate's report talked about the future of suburbs. And I know you addressed that too. The question is, what happens to housing stocks? Are we really going to see this change? You've been right about so many things over the years. What's the future of suburbs in this country?
First of all, I don't imply that we're going to give up cars,
right.
As you said.
Exactly.
As you said. And in fact, the shift that I talked about is a 20 to 25% shift. But we're still going to see the majority of trips to work in the United States being done by car. So that's the first thing. There are a lot of people that will still choose suburbs. That's not going to change. This is a pendulum. The pendulum, for a lot of reasons, went way too far in favor of the car. What I'm talking about is if we didn't have all those forces, the highway interstate defense network, the conspiracies of the automobile clubs, the modernism that thought cars were the future and the clean technology.
Motordom.
If we didn't have all those forces out there, I think we would have chosen a different way to live. So if you take a look, if you go to Europe, for example, it's a different way, but it's a balanced transportation system. When I'm thinking of what Bonnie was talking about, it's really the fragmentation. When we look at transportation as, well, the transit agency's got to do this, or the DOT has to do that. It's really the city and the region that needs to start thinking about transportation holistically and look at balanced transportation. When I met with the commissioner in Barcelona, and it's interesting that they changed the name of the transportation department to the Department of Mobility. And suddenly they started to look at how do people travel, and they began measuring trips over 10 minutes. They found the majority of trips were by walking and biking. And so suddenly you're dealing with a number of lower income people or people that don't have access to automobiles, and you're improving their transportation system. The other common theme I found in a lot of cities in Europe and even in Asia is that they have goals to reduce the amount of driving, not to zero, but to the low 20% range. So Barcelona, Zurich, and a number of other places. And so they have policies that are working towards that. And those policies are access for all. And that includes the lowest income people, and includes the people in the tuxedos on the subways. And so I think that that's key. So some suburbs are going to really suffer. And some suburbs just aren't going to see the kind of growth that they've been witnessing. Others will do just fine. But you're going to see more Austins and more Seattles.
I read your book, and it led me to think of, and again, I take so much what Mike was saying. I think what Bonnie, who called in earlier, is saying. A lot of this is sort of a privileged conversation. But I just thought when I was reading Sam's book about when you go to Europe, big cities are more sort of walk-friendly, pedestrian-friendly. But even when you travel in the countryside, it's kind of clustered in small towns, and it's still very multimodal, even in the countryside. And I suspect the change in suburbs in the future after reading Sam's book is they'll be there, but they'll have a little more centralized locations, more walkable, easily more traversable by foot, bicycle, other means, opposed to just grids everywhere and big developments, et cetera.
I think you're right, Evan. I think that as we move forward, Stan made a very interesting point in saying that it's people thinking of it being the responsibility of the Department of Transportation or the bus company or Reconnect Rochester or somebody else to make these transportation plans and decisions. It's also very much an individual choice. I have a choice every day when I wake up as to whether I want to ride the bus to work, ride my bicycle to work, or drive a car to work. And if I'm just automatically making that choice as an individual, if each of us as an individual is automatically making a choice because we don't think about it, then we do perpetuate the system that we have. If we stop and think about our options and what we're trying to accomplish and how we might do that more effectively and more healthily every single time we choose to travel, then all of these multimodal options that you're talking about do become viable.
Yeah.
And they do become very much a part of our culture.
I suspect the suburbs that thrive in the future will have a little bit more of a thoughtful look in that way. Let me grab Renee on the phone. I'm real tight for time, but go ahead, Renee.
Hi, everyone. I'm very excited to have Sam in Rochester to attend the lecture tonight, but I had a quick question about creating a culture of mass transit in Rochester. Unless we drastically change the built environment, how do we get more people who have a choice in whether they drive or not to try alternative modes of transportation when driving right now is so easy in Rochester?
It's a great question, Renee. Sam, go ahead.
Well, one of the things that I've done and I've noticed when I travel around the country, and particularly in the United States, and I'm in suburban communities or auto-centric communities, I tell the people who are in the audience, who typically I'd say median age is around 50, I would say, I'm not here to change the way you live. I'm not here to change the way you travel. But if you want to keep your children, you're going to have to think of a different way to build your cities, a different kind of built environment. And I find that with mayor after mayor, the mayor of Tampa, who has two teenage daughters, told me he wants a Tampa that his daughters stay in, not that they flee to go to some other cities. That resonates. That's when I get the attention. And we need that. Save your children. And suddenly you'll get a number of drivers who say, yeah, we're more open to biking and walking and downtown density.
Yeah. First time I ever thought about it. The young woman up the street who babysits my son didn't have a license. I said, you're almost 20 years old. She said, well, why do I want a driver's license? Finally got one, which is unusual, as Sam said. Once you get to that age, if you don't have one, you might not get one. But really, so much here in Sam's book that we didn't get to. The book is called Street Smart, The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars by Sam Schwartz. Sam, it's been great having you. Have a great event tonight at the Little Theater. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Mike Governale, real quick, the event details tonight.
6:30 p.m. tonight at the Little Theater, Theater 1, the main theater. Come out, bring your book, or buy a book at the show.
Thank you,
Ride
Mike.
Your bike.
Yeah,
ride the bus.
I was going to say, Scott Wagner, you're probably riding your bike there. Eric Frisch might walk. Great seeing you. Scott's a bicycling advocate. Eric is the transportation specialist with the city of Rochester. Always enjoy the conversation, and thanks for taking time out of your day for us, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
All right, everyone. Have a great event tonight at the Little Theater. Our thanks to Kate Cowie Haskell for her work today, contributing to the broadcast, intern for the program. Valerie Labanca is the engineer of the program, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and we'll talk to you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.